Hi, I'm Miles Milo, and I'm getting ready for Family Zoom Night in Tinley Park, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above-ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 931. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. We say good morning to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. We love Bob, and I love you for listening to the show. On the show today, we discover the secret history of a Chicago folk legend by the name of Fred Holstein. We get his story. He is awesome. And we learn about a local investigation into landlords who evict tenants who don't pay the rent because those landlords aren't providing safe living conditions. It's called the tenant trap, and we get the story. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but we have a convention coming to town very soon. Yep, the Democratic National Convention starts Monday. That means we're going to see an influx of people, security, and of course, traffic snarls. But hey, we can handle it, right? After all, this city has hosted 14 Republican National Conventions and, including this one, 12 Democratic. So what could go wrong? Okay, 1968, you're right. But let's not forget the Greenback Party convention in 1880. Yes, that's a real thing. You know, that's the one where James B. Weaver was nominated. No? Okay, checks notes. Here we go. What about in 1908 when the Independence Party had its convention here and nominated Thomas L. Hisgen? Or do you say Hisgen? That one's not ringing a bell. Well, let's see here. Certainly. Oh, this one, the Chicago-based convention of the American Party of the United States, is one you learned about in school. That, of course, is when Lester Maddox captured the party's nomination. Okay, let me look here. I'll go contemporary. In 2008, Chicago hosted the Green Party convention and nominated Cynthia McKinney. Here in Chicago, we all know who won that election. Let me just say, we've also hosted some convention nominees who went on to the big prize. Lincoln in 1860, Grant in 1868, FDR in 1932 and in 1940, Eisenhower in 1952, and Clinton in 1996. Chicago is a convention town. And not just political conventions. For example, in October, 14,000 people arrive here for the Society of Women Engineers Convention. In November, 50,000 attendees come to town for the, get this, Healthcare Packaging Expo. That's a big one. 3,000 people are coming that month for the makeup convention. Yeah, and also in November, the private label manufacturers bring 10,000 people to the Chicagoland area. There we go. I don't know if there's a parking meter convention, but that seems appropriate to have in Chicago, doesn't it? Yeah. Many Chicagoans rent their housing, and there are instances where residents are forced to live in unsafe and decaying apartments as tenants. This is one of the findings of a year-long investigation into the unfair treatment of thousands of Chicago renters. Alejandra Cancino is a senior reporter at Injustice Watch. That's a Chicago-based nonprofit journalism organization. And she is the co-author of this investigation. We can check out injusticewatch.org. And Alejandra is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Alejandra, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So what you're looking at here, I mean, this story is really something. You've got a combination of renters in unsafe housing conditions. You have rent going kind of through the roof, so to speak, when we think about those tenants in those unsafe housing conditions. So can you just generally, at the beginning here, tell us what your investigation was looking at?
Yeah, and so my colleague Maya Dugmasova and I wanted to understand what is the condition of buildings in Chicago where renters live. And so in order to do that, you know, we knew that every time that city inspectors were sent out to buildings, they will file reports, and those reports were uploaded to what's known as the data portal. So we downloaded more than a decade worth of that data, and then we analyzed it. And we wanted to know, you know, when there are building violations, there, some of them are, you know, serious violations, and some of them are not so serious. So we wanted to specifically look at the serious violations. And when we analyzed the data, we figured out that there were some buildings that had been clocking violations repeatedly over time. So they're sort of the buildings had a history of serious building code violations, and we wanted to know how many. So the number ended up being more than 2,600 buildings in Chicago have a history of serious building code violations. All of those buildings are across the city, really. This is a citywide problem. There's at least three buildings in every ward of the city, but they are disproportionately concentrated in Black communities.
And so when we talk about unsafe living conditions, building code violations, we want to emphasize that this is serious. Can you give us an example of like what a violation that you were looking for would be?
Yeah, these are violations that have to deal with health and safety. For instance, not having fire detectors in the home, that's a serious violation because there's a fire. You know, you need those fire alarms to be able to go off. Having blocked, you know, if the hallways are blocked or if there's a rat infestation in the building, it's a health violation. So those kind of the violations that kind of rise up to a level that could become really dangerous in case of an emergency.
So you downloaded this information and it was up on the data portal from the city of Chicago, and you were looking at these buildings that were logging these violations over time, not just like a one-off there, and these serious violations. So tell us what you did next, because you also interviewed more than 100 landlords, you interviewed tenants, you interviewed some experts, you even interviewed judges for this story.
Correct. So then the next question to us, what is the conditions or how many of these buildings are buildings in which low-income tenants live? And in order to do that, we ended up looking at evictions, because evictions are a measure of affordability, meaning if you cannot pay your rent or you're not paying your rent, your lender is sending you to eviction court. The majority of the time, the reason why the lenders are sending someone to eviction court is because they're not paying their rent. And so that experts consider that a measure of affordability. So then we realized that the majority of these buildings that have been clocking these serious building code violations, there's also there's a correlation between that and evictions. So as we were analyzing the data, we also connected with tenants who were organizing across the city. And some we realized as we were observing them, sort of kind of following them through the year-long investigation, that some of them decided to withhold the rent, right? It's a lot of the times when we spoke to tenants, they told us that the one thing that they feel that they have in their power is withhold rent is one of the tools that they feel is at their disposal. Mm-hmm. And Chicago has something called the Chicago Landlord-Tenant Ordinance. And if you read the ordinance, it does say that tenants have a right to withhold rent. Now, it gets very complicated. So what we found through the year-long investigation is that the majority of tenants that we observe withhold rent to try to force their landlord to improve the building conditions landed in eviction court. Hmm. So there is, at the same time, though, the city of Chicago has a number of layers that they use for enforcement. The most serious layer is sending a landlord to housing court. So what we thought was really interesting was at the same time that the landlord was sending a tenant to eviction court who was not paying rent because they were withholding it to force the landlord to fix issues in the building, at the same time, there were times in which the city itself was suing the landlord because the landlord had not complied with building code violations.
Wow.
And so we wanted to know, well, how often does that happen? And there's really no data that no one is really keeping track of that kind of data. So what we ended up doing was doing more data analysis, and we were able to find 328 cases in which the tenant was sent to eviction court at the same time that the landlord was in building court.
Wow. So this is, I think this is very Chicago. I mean, you have tenants trying to exercise their rights with one of the few options that they have, withhold rent because conditions are unsafe. And then because they're withholding that rent, the landlord is then saying, well, okay, if you're not going to pay, then I'm going to get you into eviction court. But that landlord, or these landlords, as you're talking about, have been cited multiple times in terms of violating codes in terms of livability in the city of Chicago. So that's primarily what you were looking at here. You said this is happening in mainly Black and low income communities. This is how the system works. It seems like this is a little bit of a flaw in the system, doesn't it?
So from many tenants, the tenants that we follow and that we spoke with felt really frustrated, right? How is it possible that my landlord is being sued by the city in housing court, and at the same time, I'm in eviction court, and I don't really get to say my piece in either courthouse, right? Neither judge really is asking me what's going on with my building. So we brought these findings to the chief judge, Timothy Evans, Cook County Circuit Court Chief Judge Timothy Evans, and he's he agreed that our reporting had illuminated this imbalance of power between tenants who are often unrepresented in court and the landlords. And he did say that he is working on the ability of tenants who are facing eviction to be able to, he's proposing an order. It hasn't really been adopted yet, but he's proposing an order in which the tenants will be able to ask the court whether or not the landlord is in housing court and get that information and potentially use that information as a defense in eviction court.
So we'll talk about those ideas for reforming the system in a minute here, Alejandra, but I always thought, and I think a lot of people thought this too, that tenants in Chicago had some strong laws on the books that would protect them. And towards the end of your piece up at injusticewatch.org, you do have a few like scenarios like, okay, if you're a tenant, this is happening to you, maybe you withhold rent. See, it's kind of like a choose your own adventure almost. See what happens here. Or you could try to get in touch with a lawyer or try to call 311. So am I wrong that there aren't a lot of protections for tenants, or is this the case on paper?
So on paper, you actually do hear a lot of landlords complain that tenants do have a lot of rights in the city. What we found is that for this particular population of tenants, we're talking about the mostly low-income tenants, is that they are trapped in this system. That because they are, moving has become really expensive, right? And mm-hmm. So a lot of the time, the tenants do not have the means to be able to pay for the move, pay for the security deposit, pays for the extra fees that landlords are now collecting, and continue to live in these really bad conditions. And so every scenario that we listed was a real life scenario of a tenant who chose to go that specific path in order to get some relief. And what we found was that again and again and again, the system was stacked against the tenant.
And that's amazing, even though there are laws on the books that look like they do protect the tenants. And let's come back to the reforms angle on this. The debate here, this is, I think, the conversation, and you talk about this in your piece. You say it's talking about the government regulating private property because you have these privately owned buildings and residences that, they're being rented out to people. And you also talk about landlords really looking to just profit, and make as much money as possible. So that's the conversation here. And I think that's an important thing to just kind of emphasize, that that's kind of where we're starting this when we look at the reforms. Are we talking about reforming the system at that level?
Tenant advocates have been fighting for many different kinds of reforms, and there are a number of proposals on the table right now, including one that would require to come back to periodic inspections of apartments in the city. There's another proposal that would have create a pilot program or a pilot city department that would specifically deal with landlords and tenants. So if there's ever some kind of dispute, the tenant could go to that department. I mean, one of the things that we heard again and again and again is that, yes, we have these laws in the books that technically protect tenants, but there's no one enforcing the rules, right? And so if a tenant really wanted to enforce the law, the tenant is the one who has to go and try to find a lawyer to sue the landlord in court. And even the idea of a tenant having to figure out how to find a lawyer and the lawyer trying to figure out how the law works. And, you know, even the tenants that we spoke with who did find a lawyer, who did sue the landlord, it's a process that takes a very long time. The majority of the tenants that we followed, by the time there was some kind of decision, they had moved out of their apartments. The issue was long, you know, it was years ago. That led a number of tenant advocates to think about the system as a whole. What would happen if we step way back and think about whether apartments are a human right, like a home is a human right, as opposed to thinking about having the rights of property and the rights of landlords above that human right to a home.
And that, I would think, kind of, I don't know, just turns the system upside down, because on one hand you're saying, hey, landlords, owners of these properties, I mean, in the rules of capitalism, if you own it, you can do to a degree what you want with it. So if you want to rent it out, sure. If you want to make money off that, absolutely. And that's really sort of foundational to, I think, what a lot of us would look at as success here, or the American dream, that I've got these pieces of property, I own them, they're going to go up in wealth, and maybe I can rent them out, I can make money on the side, and we look at that as success. So are we talking about maybe turning that up upside down?
Well, even under the rules of capitalism, you have regulation, right? Like if you buy something on Amazon and it was not described, you know, and it's broken, right? Like if you buy something in Amazon and it's broken, you can return it and you get a new item. If you go to the grocery store and you get a spoiled food, you can go back to the grocery store with your receipt and you get a brand new product. As a tenant, and think about it, like if you're spending, most of Chicagoans are rent burden, meaning they're spending more than a third of their income in rent. And it is your most expensive item that you pay for every month. And yet you cannot go to your landlord and say, hey, there is a leak in the roof. Like, can you fix it? Hey, there is, my heat is not working. And you have to just sort of put up with it, right? And so they are laws in the book that on technically you're not required to put up with that. I mean, what we've heard from many, even judges, we've heard, well, if you don't like it, then why don't you move out? But that is not the reality of the situation, right? Like if you think of tenants as consumers, it's really questionable about whether or not the consumer rights of a tenant are actually being upheld.
You mentioned the city of Chicago, and maybe there's something that the city can do. Can there be an agency or a department in the city government that looks at this? Do you think that's what we're going to see happen, or what's the probability maybe or the realistic sort of outlook on this? Because from what you're talking about here in your report, and again, everyone should go to injusticewatch.org and look at this study, because the stories in here, I think, are just they're emotional. They pull at your heartstrings. And these are, again, stories of real people. But do you think that the government sort of solution here might be the most practical?
Yeah, there are a number of proposals on the table. Some of them have been introduced a number of times and sort of have stalled. We heard after we finished the report that there are efforts again to try to bring some of those proposals back onto the table in 2025. So we don't know, right? We have a new, well, not so new anymore, but we have an administration that has been run on a progressive platform, and the Mayor Johnson's administration did say that tenants were a priority. So we'll see,
We will see, but we can all check out this piece up at injusticewatch.org. It is extensive. I mean, you and I, Alejandra, in this conversation, just scratched the surface. There's a lot more to look at here. And the data is really, I think, important. And you have maps up on this piece as well. So everyone should check out injusticewatch.org to see what Alejandra Cancino and her colleagues are writing about. She is a senior reporter at Injustice Watch. That is a Chicago-based nonprofit newsroom. Alejandra, thank you so much for talking to us today. Thanks for all your hard work.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
In the Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who is born on a muggy, hot morn by the dawn's early light.
Once again, here we go. The Secret History of Chicago Music strip in the Chicago Reader and on ChicagoReader.com. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip, local music historian, musician, artist. And I think, Steve, what you do largely, a lot of these bands and these musicians that you profile, it's all kind of like news to us. But I have to say that I've heard of this guy, Fred Holstein. He is, I think it's safe to say, a legend when it comes to Chicago folk music. Is that accurate?
Yeah, and you know, and I would kind of phrase it sort of like you did. I heard of him. Yeah. I think I even one day went down a little well and was like, oh, interesting, you know. And, you know, I obviously, you know, I do that very often. So, you know, filed it in the back of my brain and then found his record. And that, oh, you know, at the thrift store, which is, as I've said, one of my favorite ways to sort of stumble on an artist, I say, you know, you've made it when you're at the thrift store. You know, that's when you know you've got your LP has gone through a few cycles of ownership. But anyways, yeah, seeing his record and listening to it and the liner notes and stuff, like, you know, I really, anyone who just streams music, I gotta say, you're missing out a little bit on this kind of thing. I'll just interject that little aside there, but yeah, and then, you know, just went into his history and wow, you're right, total legend.
Right, and his story is really incredible, and the people that he inspired and that he interacted with, I think that's also part of this story. And I love it. Fred Holstein, born and bred on the south side of Chicago, December 9th, 1942. And as you write, he never really builds a significant following outside of Chicago. Although I guess if you're really into folk music, you're going to know him. But he was really this local success story.
Yeah, you know, that's another thing that hit me. Very beloved here, not as much elsewhere, you know, known as much elsewhere. And, you know, I think part of it is that he was not a songwriter per se himself. Like that I think was the fundamental thing I got picking up his album and seeing, like, ah, you know, he's kind of like, his hero that got him to pick up guitar was like Pete Seeger, you know, who did a lot of like commie work songs and traditional right. songs and stuff like that. And he was really one of those guys. He really was in that tree, which is very important. And, you know, and I said probably the best way to describe him was really like an ethnomusicologist, because he supposedly had this catalog of, you know, unrecorded and recorded song in his head of like 300 tunes. So, you know, he was more like a, you know, a historian of this sort of music, but then also, you know, sort of concurrently didn't really give a toot about how he presented it. And, you know, supposedly he sort of gave these great ramshackle performances that were, you know, much more about just sort of like, the, you know, the sort of sacredness of this song than like him dressing it up, you know, for you. Or, you know, I call it working man's folk. You know, yeah. And I think it took me a little bit to come around to the Chicago school of folk, which is really a sort of more, you know, you think of John Prine, you think of Steve Goodman. Those guys were sort of like, you know, singing these songs. And I think he was a big influence on, he mentored Steve Goodman.
He's really like the live situation. I mean, he's playing it the way he wants it. It's going to be, it's not going to be in your face. It's going to be a, maybe a little bit more reserved, a little bit more sort of storytelling-ish. But that's how he's playing this music.
In all your towns, the sweetest breeze to blow me down was an old Chicago. Old Chicago. Old Chicago, round the lake, round where the girls go, where the breeze comes here to blow, in old Chicago.
I wish, you know, after researching him, I was like, darn, I sure wish I could have seen this guy, you know, and he had his own club.
That's right. I mean, Holstein's, right?
Yeah, well, you know, he co-founded this club I'd read about a million times called Somebody Else's Troubles, which is, funny enough, the title of his second album. And that was a partnership with Steve Goodman and some of these other, his younger brother, Ed, who's also a musician and I guess a bartender guy, Henry the Duke Nathaus.
Nice.
Yeah, there's a guy to look into. So anyway, you know, he was co-owner of this club. You know, important place I read about quite a bit. And then he started his own place, Holstein's, I believe in Lincoln Park area in the late 70s, early 80s. Let me check my own research here. 81. I was right there in the pocket. So, yeah. And, you know, it didn't last terribly long, only about 5 years. But that's another place I would read about quite a bit as a sort of important venue for all these artists.
You know, it's interesting because I think the geography here, I mean, he is going to, in the early 1960s, he's going to work at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And he's going to take lessons there. He's going to play there. He's going to work there. But like you're saying, he's also playing some of these clubs like in Lincoln Park and the areas around sort of the near north side, if you will. So these areas that today, I mean, none of these places exist except the Old Town School of Folk Music. That even moved. But these other clubs don't exist anymore. But really, that was part of the story. He was kind of, as you say, he's really the lifeblood of Chicago folk music. So without Fred Holstein, things are going to look a little different here and sound different in Chicago.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just for the fact that, you know, Steve Goodman is, you know, such a revered name in the scene, and that, you know, he basically mentored him, you know, that alone. But, you know, it sounds like Bonnie Kolak had a lot of respect for him too, as being the real deal. And, you know, like I said, I've come around. I always wanted my sort of folk to be either more like political, fanciful, or, you know, maybe avant-garde. I don't know. I don't know what I wanted on my folk. It wasn't really this sort of working man's thing that now I completely appreciate. Maybe it's just getting older, you know, but I hear it now. There's this sort of ruggedness there's a Chicago sound. And when I heard, you know, Fred's record, you know, it really, there's a spareness to it, you know. And, you know, I found a quote for him where he was just like, understand the song is a lot more important than you are. And I was like, whoa. You know, and I was like, that's intense. And that really does sort of sum up like these sort of, you know, story songs of like struggle and loss and, you know, sort of a down to earth kind of thing. I think that was just a big thing, you know, here. And I appreciate it a lot more now.
So Fred Holstein, he's continuing to play, as you say, in 1981, Fred Holstein and his younger brothers opened the venue Holstein's on Lincoln near Fullerton. It closes, though, in 1988 on New Year's Day, unfortunately. So he keeps, Fred Holstein keeps working as a bartender, and he is going to perform, although it's really starting to dwindle off in the early 21st century. So how does this story end up here?
Well, sadly, you know, I mean, his health deteriorated a little bit, so he wasn't really able to play like he used to. And, you know, he would often like headline or open at his own club, so he didn't have that venue anymore. And, you know, maybe things sort of shifted in the music scene a bit, you know, especially by the 90s, you know, you weren't really hearing about, you know, the rugged folk scene of Chicago so much anymore and all that. But in 2001, so he played only kind of sporadically. He released this sort of retrospective double CD with like both of his albums, live recordings, stuff, radio shows and stuff that he had done. And I think it rejuvenated interest a little bit. And he ended up playing pretty often at Abbey Pub. And God, I regret not going to one of those. This was in the era I was in Chicago. You know, I could have caught this, but often playing with his brother, you know, with him or opening and stuff. So that would have been a really cool venue to see him at. But yeah, he passed in 2004. He was only 61.
Wow.
And had to have emergency abdominal surgery at Old Swedish Covenant Hospital. And got him.
Man.
2004, 20 years ago, almost, it was January. So a little over 20 years ago,
man. Well, he is appreciated, I know, by many folk musicians today. And, he goes way too early in 2004, unfortunately, at the age of 61, like you said. And really, again, this is a guy that you should at least know about when we talk about Chicago history. If you're into folk music, I mean, I think I was growing up here, and I was, you know, in the early 2000s, I was up at Loyola and Rogers Park. And I just think of all the little nooks and crannies up there and the folkies that play places like the No Exit Cafe and, you know, stuff like that. So I think
that
it still exists to a degree, but man, it was pretty influential.
Definitely. And as you said, the Old Town, which, you know, is different location, but, you know, still sort of encourages the same sort of, you know, music history, you know, folk music history, all music. I mean, folk is, you know, obviously a sort of, you know, like all genres, you got to sort of package up music, but, you know, it really just means like music of the people, you know, and Old Town definitely supports that. I've seen so many different kinds of crazy shows, bands from like Armenia, bands from Africa there. And, it, you know, that's all folk music. That is their indigenous music that they grew up on and was, you know, handed down for generations. And it's important. And that's what Fred Holstein seemed to be about with me. So mad respect to the Holstein for being a fellow ethnomusicologist.
Mad respect to the Fred Holstein. We love him. He is being profiled in this week's Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. It is in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. So check it out. Steve Krakow is the author of the Secret History of Chicago Music Strip, also a music historian and artist. And Steve, I appreciate your time. Thanks for giving us the story of Fred Holstein. And mad respect to that ethnomusicologist. What a title.
Right on. And I always say I learn something every time I do one. People are like, how do you know all this stuff? And it's like, you know what? I do research, and it's joyful for me because I learn stuff every time. And this was one in particular that I'm like, I'm glad I got into the world of Fred Holstein.
I never knew my granddad. He was always on the bum. Every September he'd catch him a southbound and ride. Long about.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 931 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer today in the WGN radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week ahead, and I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.